You're an a- Can we use that?
Not only can we not use it, I'm thinking of hanging up.
Now you're just offended.
Wow. That's...
It's productive. We're not being productive.
All right, let's just do the show, I guess. Hello, and welcome to episode 69 of the Two Hosers Photo Show. My name is Alan, and I am in Tubingen. With me, as always,
Adam, Vancouver, British Columbia.
Take it from there.
And with sometimes...
It's like we didn't rehearse this.
No, it was totally unrehearsed.
We only did it three times.
Oh, this is raw, in the raw.
Okay, who's that third voice?
That would be Dawn in Barrie, Ontario, Canada.
Welcome back, Dawn. Dawn, you heard last week on part one of Raw.
And you didn't scream to have me shunned from the show, so here I am again.
Everyone was, it was like a cliffhanger. They're all they're on the edge of their seats saying, what's going to happen next?
That, and we didn't have anything else prepared, so we thought we'd call you at the last minute.
I appreciate that, I think.
Yeah, I didn't want to say it, but all right. I guess we're all about transparency here.
That's right. Peek behind the curtain.
So refresh anyone's memory, Don. Where do we know you from?
We've never actually met. And I'm trying to think, how did I actually get in touch with you in the first place? I think I just randomly sent you an email at some point. But I'm a professional photographer. I do some work for Outdoor Photography Canada, and I'm a photography teacher and all sorts of fun stuff. And I like to ramble on about things that hopefully somebody cares about in the photography community. And you give me the ability to do that.
Now, that's Outdoor Photography Canada magazine.
Yes.
I urge people to check that out. Check it out online. Really like that magazine.
If you check out their website, they've had, in the latest issue, they did a photographer profile on me. So they had a writer call me and ask me a bunch of questions, and then they did a big write-up. So I'm in there, and if you want to know more about me, you just pick up the latest issue. But they've got a little blurb on their website about how I made some lightning photographs, and you can check that out for free. It's just on their website, which is, what is it, outdoorphotographycanada.com.
Enter it in the Google if you're unsure. I'll bet you it pops up.
I hope so.
Adam.
Yes.
How you feeling, buddy?
Pretty good, thanks.
Canucks?
Let's not talk about it.
No, we're going to get into it. We're going to get into it right now.
Yes, they're out. I think any hockey fan that isn't from Vancouver is probably laughing right now. And I'd just like to say that... The boys will be back next year to do it all over again. So I don't have anything else to say. I'm not going to be critical of my team in this hour. I just feel that it's compared to last year where they went all the way to the Stanley Cup Finals and disappointed me in the Game 7, the last possible moment at home, having the Boston Bruins carry the Stanley Cup around in our building. This disappointment seems far less because an early exit means lots of spring evenings free from watching hockey.
And the city won't be on fire.
Yeah, exactly. Nobody's going to burn anything. So you know what the general mood is? I think there's consensus among a little bit of disappointment, but nothing compared to the disappointment of losing in a Game 7 of the Stanley Cup final. So
true.
Yeah. So there you have it. State of the Union.
On the other hand, if they go all the way to the Stanley Cup final, free pants from the suit place.
Really?
I don't know. Whatever else you can smash and steal. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Free TVs from free, London Drugs.
Free TVs. That was probably a better joke.
Yeah.
Let's take that again. Hey.
Yeah, try it again.
Okay. Dawn, what'd you shoot this week?
Well, dandelions. I did a bit of macro work, and they're one of the only flowers that are out and about in abundance. So I did a little study on those.
Are they flowers or are they weeds, like my dad said when I was a kid?
Well, they're both, but they're a very beautiful flower to photograph. And, you know, insects love them this time of the year because there's nothing else. So you can find all sorts of cool bugs. You can do some really microscopic work if you've got the equipment for it, and you can see some fun some details in the pollen and water droplet refractions that I've been playing around with work really well with dandelions. Yeah, I mean, there's fun to be had there. And because the spring came a little bit early, there's like fields of dandelions everywhere around here, even though over the last 2 days we've had snowstorms, which I'm not so happy about.
Yeah, that's another plus side of living in Vancouver, I suppose.
What? No snow ever?
Your team makes the playoffs and you don't have snow?
No snow in April.
We haven't had much in the way of sun either, though, so.
Yeah. Well, thanks for making my point for me, Adam.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yes, and. Remember we talked about this.
Right. Sorry, I'm going to try to do better now, sir.
And beyond the flowers, I decided to head out today and actually try and find some trilliums because I wanted to try and get a photograph of some red trilliums in snow. But all the places that I had gone and traveled to, the trilliums hadn't quite opened up yet. So that was a bit of a disappointment. This evening, however, I was just down in Toronto attending Art Battle. And it's a fun little, competition between a bunch of different artists. This time they were doing paintings in pairs and just sort of random, no real rules to what you have to paint, but you've got 20 minutes to get it done, and then at the end of it, it's all voted on. And my fiance was participating in it, and I got quite a bit of nice photographs from that event as well.
So what can you paint in 20 minutes? Are they good?
I mean, some of these things were absolutely fantastic. Abstract paintings, impressionist stuff, some really weird, like, monsters with eyes all over the place, and just some goofy stuff. But every painting had a different style and a different feel, and I don't know if they picked the artists specifically because they do have different styles, but I was really impressed. And then afterwards, they auction off the artwork, and that gives them a little bit of revenue to keep the whole system running.
I feel
so
like
there's a crowd watching this that they're auctioning it to?
I'm going to guess there was over 100 people watching.
Wow. What are they doing while the painting's going? Are they watching or are they just heckling?
A little bit of both, and walking counterclockwise.
Nice.
Like Ring Around the Rosie.
A little bit.
Okay.
Okay, and Adam, what did you shoot this week?
Only one little portrait session, which was my daughter and son attended a hockey birthday party for a 5-year-old friend of ours. So they had it at like a little gymnasium, and it was a boy's birthday party, and he's big into hockey. And so it was kind of everybody wear your jerseys and play indoor floor hockey. So a bunch of kids playing indoor floor hockey. And so with friends of ours, I brought my camera, took some action shots of the kids playing hockey, and took a bunch of, you know, basically the kids playing games, mostly targeted at their son so I could email them off to them, but a few of my kids as well. So just good old-fashioned kids playing games action shots.
Do you feel like you get invited to these parties because you're the camera guy?
Nope, because my kids are a good time.
Didn't we, I think someone used that zinger on me last week now that I mentioned it.
That
getting invited just because you're the camera guy.
It's happened to me many times.
Yeah, I don't think it hurts. I don't do it for a career. So for you guys, it seems like a little bit more of an obvious choice. But my friends do know that that I take pictures, and so certainly it's better than them firing them all their kids blowing out the birthday candles with their iPhones. So
yeah, I find though the one rub for me is that a lot of people end up figuring, oh, well, Al's going to be there, so I won't bring my camera at all.
Right.
And then it falls on you to document the day.
I think there is some mild level of expectation, but certainly with these friends, I really don't think that there is. Of course, they appreciate it and they like the photos, which is why for certain people, I have no problem and often feel like I want to, because they really appreciate it as opposed to expect it.
And plus, you don't have to buy a gift.
Well, yeah, we still do. We bought a hockey-related gift, so that's fun. I actually got to be the one that shopped for the present, so I actually enjoy that when it is something up my alley, so to speak.
Okay.
Yeah.
I shot more babies, of course.
Okay.
That's what you do. And
with a camera, right?
With a camera. Yep, to clarify, in case the police are listening. So that was boring for everyone listening. But because they just sit there. I did a couple of two separate pro jobs, like sort of like corporate style headshots. That was, you know, again, also.
Where's the takeaway from shooting portraits of babies? Where's the tip in there? There's something there that that we're not tapping into. Do you have a move for the baby photo? Is there something that you like specifically to take that in every session with babies you try to do?
That's a good question, because I try not to go too crazy. Like the pictures tend to look very similar. Mostly because it's not like everybody is knows each other and is all going to compare the shots and say, oh, I have that very same one.
Right.
And there's only so much you can do with babies.
And now we're talking about home from the hospital now, like a few weeks old babies, yeah?
Oh, days old. Days, yeah.
Okay.
So I like to try to include them with their siblings if they have, you know, older siblings. Maybe try to incorporate.
Do you put like a knitted hat on them?
My wife actually has started crocheting, so she crocheted some hats for these kids. So yes, the answer is yes, they get the knitted hat.
I often see the shot of, you know, either the, it's usually, I think it's a shot that I've seen most often with the father, where the baby at that kind of age is just kind of in almost the palm of their hand or along their arm with the hand kind of cupping the head. Is that a go-to shot?
That's, we try that one too, yeah. It's a little nerve-wracking because you don't want to drop the kid.
Well, you're not holding it.
No, right? I'm not holding. That's the one thing. if there is one takeaway I can give when doing this, let the mom or the dad handle the kid.
Right.
I'd never, ever, ever, like, even the slightest little move, I'll just say, okay, can we move him that way? I'd never, never get involved.
Right, even with your own child.
Yeah, that's right. Kind of an absentee on that one. So, and then I did one other, two other jobs I was telling you about where I wanted to mention that counting clicks came in very, very handy. When I had to make a quick adjustment using off-camera flash to the, I wanted to quickly drop the level of the background light.
Right.
And I was already at the lowest possible setting on my flash for the background, so I had to basically change that in camera, which meant having to adjust the key light, which meant basically having to count the number of clicks. But what normally would take, you know, would have taken me before, like, you know, a few minutes or maybe even 10 minutes to reset, took a matter of seconds because of the counting clicks.
Okay.
So listen back.
I did some of that this evening as well.
It's a handy tip. So
as long as you understand all the mechanics behind it, like the back of your hand, and then that tip becomes a lot more powerful because then you're not fumbling through menus. You're just using those clicks to your advantage. But if you don't understand exactly what's happening with those clicks, then you've got to learn up on that first and get comfortable with it before it'll be useful.
Yeah, absolutely. You need to get, that's the whole idea, is to get the camera out of your way.
So go listen to episode, whatever episode that was.
Yeah, I don't remember which one that was. A few
it was only ago. A few episodes ago, yeah.
Yeah.
Recent, yeah.
So this week's photo challenge, it was go wide. The end.
That was the challenge, yeah.
Yeah, so who wants to start?
Alan, you start.
Wow, I don't think I've ever started before.
I was just giving it that awkward silence move. I was going to see how long Don was going to wait until someone said something.
We had that planned out.
I would have left that go for like 4 minutes.
That would have been just good podcasting. Yeah. Okay, we'll start with mine. Now, go wide. I interpreted my challenge to be use a wide-angle lens.
Okay.
And so I wanted to go get this nice sweeping vista of a landscape. And so I hiked out through the woods to get that, and then the weather did not cooperate. So I didn't get the wide sweeping vista that I wanted. And so instead I shot a sort of an area near where we live used to be used to house the French army after World War II up until 1990 was when they left. Like, they stayed here and trained here, and basically the French army lived here. And so they, out in the woods, they have a bunch of sort of emplacements or some stuff left over from when they were here. And this gate is one of them. So it's this kind of disembodied wall slash doorway firing range. I don't know what it. I think it was a firing range, and just sort of in the middle of nowhere. So I shot it wide.
Okay. Very well framed.
Well, thanks. I had to kind of climb in through some bushes to get there, to get exactly in that spot. But this is shot on my full frame camera, the 5D Mark II, at 17 mil. With 17-40 f/4 lens, and I went all the way out to 17 to really hammer home the wide angle.
Well, one of the things that I find with wide angle lenses too is sometimes getting it aligned to be symmetrical can be a bit more tricky.
Yeah.
But it like you've got it perfect here, so you've got the symmetry where, you know, all the angles are coming up, and it, you know, if they have a point of convergence, it would be in the center of the frame, you know, probably outside of the frame in certain cases, but in the center. And I think that that really draws your eye inward towards the center of it. And I'm looking at the sky too, and thinking that the sky is probably quite a bit lighter than the shadowed structures in the foreground. And I'm wondering if you've had to, you know, play around and bring down those highlights or bring up the shadows, and how you processed it.
Don, that's why you're on the show all the time, man. That's exactly, you nailed it. I wasn't going to do it, but I thought for the sake of our raw discussion later in the show, I'm going to bring that sky right down. Oh, Don.
And it worked.
You're growing up so fast. Adam,
I don't know what to say about that. I think that's a compliment, but I'm not sure.
I'm going to wipe my tears away and try to power through the rest of the show. No, that's exactly right. That's a good call. There's no way I would be able to normally sort of have the latitude to expose for the shadows and the sky. So
what was your ISO set at?
ISO, I don't remember. Would have been, I'm going to guess, probably 320.
Okay.
Might have been 640, depending, because it was kind of it was actually very shadowy where I was. Like in the woods where I was standing was pretty dark.
Right.
And so
the reason why I ask is I had been doing a bit more research and looking through some charts at DxO Labs, and discovered something else about raw files that is worth mentioning. I know we're getting into it a little bit later, but if you have a camera set to a lower ISO setting, whatever the base level ISO is, I think Nikons are most often 200 ISO and Canon is 100, but you'll have the highest amount of dynamic range at the lower settings.
Right.
So if you want to pull back detail from highlights or shadows, lower ISO will allow you to do it far more successfully than shooting at ISO 1600 or 3200. That data is just gone, even in a RAW file.
That's what I've heard. Yeah, I haven't gone too far into messing around with that, but yeah, good tip. So that's my wide. Adam, what do you think? Yeah.
What do I think about your photo?
Sure.
I think that my first glance, I liked it. The only thing I find is the trees kind of through the tunnel distracting. Obviously you can't do anything about that, but if that was the sky without the trees, I would like the photo a lot more, because where the trees blend in with, I guess, the mossy bits mm-hmm. on the top of the... on the whatever you call the archway, I find it kind of gets a little bit muddled in there with what is background and what is foreground. But that's it. I mean, and again, it's nothing you could have done differently. I like the framing of the shot, like Don said. I like the symmetry of the photo, and I like the fact you can see into the shadows and just the colors on the inside of the tunnel. Just again, I love photos that look like worn away, you know. So I like the historical sense. I found that your story definitely helped the photo as well. So your lead up with the historical background helped the story. Otherwise, I would have thought less of the photo.
A rare time when a long-winded story was helpful.
Yeah, it helped your photo for sure.
Don't encourage.
Well, what is that in the upper left-hand corner? It looks like out of focus, like it's a twig or a branch or something in the foreground.
It absolutely, Don, you're killing this, man. That is absolutely what that is. I could not get past that. Like, right in front of me is a wire fence, which you can't see in the picture. But I'm as close as I can get, and so I can't get past that last twig hanging from a tree.
That's what Photoshop's for.
Yeah, I wanted to be more real and just say, well, you know, I blew it. On the left hand side, you see the big dark twig, and then on little closer to the middle, there's sort of the green leaves and that hanging there as well.
I don't mind that at all, though.
Yeah, well, I could have got rid of it in Photoshop, but figured, that's how it is. Leave it in there. So, all right, let's go to Don's photo. Don, this one was taken moments ago, I think.
Yeah, that was probably taken at this point probably about 2.5 hours ago.
Okay, and what's going on here?
This is the art battle that I was talking about down in Toronto, and my fiance is taking part in this competition, and she's paired up with another painter, and over 20 minutes, you are to create a painting of whatever you want it to be, and you're competing directly against five other teams, and then whoever wins from that goes on to the next round, and they have tons of spectators. I would have guessed probably around 100 people, maybe to 120 people were there spectating, and after the event, if you can see in the sort of the upper right-hand corner of the screen, or of the image rather, the paintings are all laid out for private, silent auction. So this was in an old theater, and I climbed up to the balcony, and I had the fisheye lens on the camera, which is one of the widest angle lenses you can get. It's a 180-degree view from corner to corner.
Okay.
And so I held the camera out as far over the floor as I could, angled it down, sort of guessing at the proper angle, and then fired off a bunch of shots. And if I got the angle wrong, I would just try again, because there's no way that I could even see the LCD screen the way I was holding it to benefit from live view. It was sort of guesswork. And I tried about 3 or 4 times, and I got it on the fourth try to get the proper framing of the shot.
Nice. I like it.
Me too.
Composition-wise, I like how the light changes color as it falls off into the audience.
Yeah, they had, spotlights up above from where the photo was positioned, and they were having blue spotlights on the crowd, and that was an intentional, design of how this whole thing was set up. What I find is quite difficult when you're dealing with a fisheye lens is you have so much in the frame at any given time that there's a lot of clutter that can often be introduced.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm lucky in this case that there wasn't light hitting the corners. It all sort of draws it right in towards the center, and your eyes don't get distracted by things on the edges.
And by holding the camera over the balcony, you didn't shoot your feet.
That's right.
Which I know it sounds funny, but that happens.
Oh, I've got tons of photos taken with that lens that have my feet in them.
Yeah, and feet and shadows. Your shadows often pop up. Because we're no place for them to go. So on the plus side, the chances of this being in focus are pretty much 100%.
And that's another beautiful thing about wide-angle lenses. The wider the angle of the lens, the more you'll have in focus at any given aperture.
Yep.
So this was, I think, at f... I'm not even sure. I know that I was shooting at f3.5 for a lot of the evening. And I'm guaranteed to have pretty much front-to-back focus as long as I've got my focus point proper. And then I haven't missed the focus.
Right.
I'm guaranteed to have, you know, the crowd in the background, the people in the foreground in focus with this particular lens. It's one of the reasons why I love it. I've done some night landscape shots with it where I'm shooting it wide open at f2.8 and everything's in focus. It's beautiful.
Now, did you shoot some longer lens stuff at this event as well?
I put my 24 to 105 on, and I did some shooting at 24 primarily. Longer, not really feasible in this case. A little bit when I was shooting down to get some of the canvas work, but that was maybe 50 millimeters max.
Okay.
the wider angles were more useful because it was a fairly small space, and I wanted to show it to be expansive and not cramped. And there's a lot of people around, so I couldn't get back far enough behind people to shoot wide or to shoot with a telephoto. So I had to get up close, and wide angle is my only choice.
Right. We'll have an episode in the future all about wide angle and how to shoot it. And basically, it's going to basically be for realtors who want to showcase houses.
And disappoint the people when they arrive.
Exactly. They're the ones who really make use of the wide-angle lens.
But great for the online shoppers who just buy their homes before they arrive.
So they should listen in to understand the tricks of the trade. So, Adam, you went a little different way with yours.
Yeah, I was on a time crunch. You moved the date of this podcast 2 days earlier than usual recording, so... Mm-hmm. Being that I worked right up until a couple hours before this podcast, I worked with what I had at home, which was my wife's eye. I figured wide open eye.
There's nothing. So there's no right or wrong when it comes to interpretation.
Yeah.
Except
so
this
I
one's wrong.
I took a photo of my wife's eye. There it is. The end.
Her eye is wide open. The pupil.
It is.
And everything.
Yeah, and you can see I used an umbrella. It's showing up in her eye as such.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Which lens did you use with this?
I used the 30mm, and this is obviously cropped. So I was standing back, I don't know, 3 or 4 feet from her eye, shooting down from an angle. And then I rotated the image to make it look square. But yeah, I was standing up on a chair, shooting down at her eye with the light aimed kind of at about a 45-degree angle up and to her left. That is her left eye.
Her left
eye. As you can see from the eyebrow direction, I think.
Okay.
Now, how much ambient light was there in this photograph?
Not that much. The way our room is lit, I had her, we don't have a ceiling light on that side of the room. So most of the light is coming from the other side of the room. And it's kind of a very orangey yellow light, which is why I didn't want to shoot it there. And so I brought her onto the other side of the room. And being that I wanted to make sure her face and her eye was going to be exposed, then I used the flash and the umbrella.
So why do you ask about ambient light?
Because that determines how wide that pupil is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Because if you have more ambient light, that pupil is going to be smaller. Because just the way your eye works, of course, is what the more light's around you, the smaller your pupil gets because the less light it needs to actually resolve its own image. But if you're in a pretty dark environment, your pupil is going to get as big as it can. And then if you blast it with light from a flash, it doesn't have time to react and shrink down before the image is made. Okay. So you'll get people with really big looking pupils if the ambient light is very low.
Well, there you go. I did that on purpose to get a big pupil.
And is that not how the red eye setting on your camera, like on your point and shoot? It's my understanding that's how that works, is it fires off a series of flashes to get your pupil to shrink down.
Exactly. That's the trick that they're trying to do. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah.
But that's sort of the idea that they're playing on. I've never really had reliable success with the red eye setting on point and shoots, though.
No. Neither have I. So that brings us to this week's topic. Good job, Adam, by the way.
Thank you.
And I'm sure your wife appreciates posting her wrinkles to the world to see.
Yeah, that's why I also I pumped it up with the umbrella to blast away a few of those of the small little wrinkles and imperfections that I knew she would not let me post on the web.
Plus, she looks good for 75.
Yeah, and I like the fact that she had green eyes. That's why it's not a black and white.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good choice. I like it. Raw part two.
That's buckle your seatbelts. Yeah, just buckle your seatbelts. Here we go. Things are about to pick up.
I can't believe they left the show off where they did last week. What's going to happen next? What is going to happen next? Well, let's talk about it. We talked all about what RAW is. Now, do we need to refresh or just tell people to go listen back to last episode?
Popular wrestling show on Monday nights.
That's what it is. Eddie Murphy. We've got all the different jokes we got in there. But ultimately, it is the raw data that comes off your camera sensor without processing. So if that's what we're shooting, that means we have to process it.
No choice.
How do we do that? So, first of all, Don, would you want to outlay your typical RAW workflow? What is your typical RAW workflow?
Well, of course, shooting RAW in the camera and then taking that data on the memory card, plugging it into the computer, and I have it configured so that Adobe Photoshop Lightroom pops up automatically, sees the card, and gives me the option to import all of that data in there. And, you know, at that exact point, this is where you can start to organize things. And I don't, and I'm probably foolish for it because it would make my life a lot easier down the road. Where you can plug in keywords and you can do this with JPEGs too. It's not exclusive to RAW, but it helps you organize things. So you can plug in keywords, you can set up certain metadata, which means you can embed your copyright information and all that type of stuff. And that's part of the workflow, making sure that it's labeled properly, even though I don't do that as often as I should.
Right. The copyright is easy enough to add later.
It is, yeah.
I find that adding keywords is kind of important at the beginning, because you're not going to go back and add keywords to photos that you shot in 2009.
No, but I'll go through my process, and you'll see why that's not entirely necessary down the road. But when I'm dealing with the image, the first stop is going to be in Lightroom, and Lightroom is one of the most flexible and powerful both RAW processing engines as well as organizational tools to organize everything together for me. So I bring the image in, and sometimes there is a little auto button on there, and sometimes I just click it to see what happens, and I never like what happens, but sometimes it points me in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'll go down the list, just sort of from top to bottom through all of the different settings that Lightroom has, adjusting for the white balance if it's necessary, the exposure, the highlights, the whites, the shadows, the blacks, the clarity, all the different settings through there. And if any of those need adjusting, then I'll sway them into whatever direction I see fit for that image. Sometimes I might increase the contrast, sometimes I might decrease it depending on the mood of the shot. Typically, those basic settings, if I've done an entire shoot at the same location, chances are those settings are going to be about the same for everyone. So I'll pick a good representation of the photos that I've taken, and I start to do all of these basic adjustments. Beyond that, I will continue to go down through that stack and adjust colors separately and do some noise reduction if I'm shooting at a higher ISO and sometimes sharpening depending on the macro work that I'm doing. A really fun feature in Lightroom that I almost always use, with the exception of the photo that you'll see in this episode, the fisheye photo, is the lens correction. Mm-hmm. And I think that's new in one of the newer Photoshops. It does a lot of work to remove imperfections in the lenses, distortion and color fringing and stuff that you don't want, just by clicking a button. If it's got the profile in there and it's got most cameras and lenses, then it automatically fixes that stuff for you.
For the most part, when I'm shooting RAW, I try as hard as I can to get everything right in the camera.
That's right, yeah. And while, yes, you can save an image, you shouldn't need to save an image, and you shouldn't use that as a crutch. And that goes back to all sorts of stuff that you make sure you get your exposure right in the camera. And I know you've talked about histograms and all the tools that your camera gives you to get the proper exposure. But when you're dealing with the raw data, you can still massage it in certain ways.
Right.
For example, today's photograph, the wide shot that I used, I brought down the highlights because the white and the bright colors in the center of the image were getting a lot more exposure because they had more direct light pointed on them than the audience surrounding them did. So I brought those colors down. My exposure was perfect, but some of the areas were still too bright given the overall image. So,
a much larger dynamic range than your camera could handle.
Exactly. I could see it all fine myself with my own eyes, but the camera sees things differently. It's a little bit more limited. So bringing things back into the range is pretty easy to do if it's not too far out, just by adjusting those sliders.
So do you convert to DNG?
I used to, and I no longer do.
Good. What is DNG?
Adam, DNG
listen up.
Is is the digital negative format that Adobe created as something of a standard for RAW files, so that any open source RAW program can, you know, use the DNG format and understand how it works. And basically, it takes your RAW data and wraps it with a recipe for how to process it. And that makes it future-proof, so that, you know, say 70 years from now, if you had an obscure camera model that is no longer supported by the RAW processing software of that day, then your RAW files can still be used because they had been converted with this recipe built into them. And that allows them to be read by any program that recognizes DNG.
So Canon has their own format, Nikon has their own format, and so on.
Every camera manufacturer has their own format. Very few of them will record to DNG natively. It's something that you have to convert.
Okay.
I think some, like, I don't know if it's Ricoh or some of the smaller manufacturers that don't bother to make their own RAW formats and all that sort of stuff, and they just go for the standard. But 99.9% of people out there won't have that. You'd have the choice to convert to it. If you've got an obscure camera, it might be worthwhile, but, you know, I've been shooting with a 5D Mark II, and it's a hugely popular camera. I'm never worried that these images, you know, will have trouble being read in the future. It's a guarantee that they'll be readable. So, and it takes time to you know, do this extra step, and I'm lazy, and I just don't want to do it.
For the record, I do not convert to DNG. I don't even know that Aperture will handle it. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. I don't know enough about it. I have no problem with my own workflow, so I'm happy with it. Adam, DNG?
I missed the last 7 minutes. I was in the bathroom.
So I'm guessing you're not a big DNG guy either.
No, I'm not a DNG guy.
So it's not necessary.
No, and it doesn't help you in any ways, at least not today.
So when it comes time to process, what sort of what are our options for software?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of big ones. You mentioned Aperture, and I use Lightroom, and those are sort of the two big heavy hitters, the Pepsis and Cokes of the photographic processing world.
Which one's Pepsi?
Aperture.
I think Aperture is as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But beyond that, most camera manufacturers, at least that, you know, Nikon and Canon, will produce their own RAW processing software as well. That, you know, I use Canon, and I know they offer the Digital Photo Professional software free of charge to anybody with a Canon camera capable of shooting RAW. And so you can go that route without spending any money, but I don't recommend it. I don't know if there's a legal reason why they have to offer it, if it's a, you know, something in their camera, but it's just not nearly as powerful. And the only time when I'd ever use it is if I'm doing some very, you know, odd type of photography. If I'm shooting in infrared, or just the other day I decided to play around and use a piece of welding glass as an ND filter, a neutral density filter, and this throws your white balance way off the scale. The camera can correct for it, and the Digital Photo Professional software will correct for it accurately. If you bring that into Lightroom or Aperture, their sliders don't go far enough in whatever direction they need to go, and your white balance still isn't accurate. Okay. And there's ways around that. You can create custom DNG profiles, and it gets pretty deep. But there are still some things that the camera manufacturer software is better at. But most of the time, stick with the stuff that everybody else is using, because you'll also get better help if you have any problems.
No, that's true. I started out, you know, when I first started shooting, before I bought anything, I used the Canon included software, and it was fine. Like, it'll get the job done, but Aperture, Lightroom, it's all kind of one-stop shopping, organizing, and doing all your RAW correction. So, I'm pretty good at, as we showed last week, I'm pretty good at rescuing a misexposed shot, which is one of the really advantages of shooting RAW, is the big one for me is white balance. If you miss white balance, it's really easy to set, which we talked about last week.
Yep.
But rescuing an overexposed shot is fairly easy. You can basically grab this, you know, any of the sliders. You can grab the exposure slider and bring it back. What I'm not good necessarily at is doing what you talked about, is basically saving the highlights while keeping good skin tones.
And I, you know, I, I've I want to do more research into this, but I think one of the bigger issues is that the different color channels. Last week we talked about how a camera sensor has red, green, and blue color filters in front of different pixels on the sensor. And my thought on this, and I could be totally out to lunch, but it's that some of those pixels will clip before others do. So when you bring that slider back down, say if the red channel clipped before the green and the blue, then it's going to skew the colors when you try and bring that back down, because some of them will have data and others won't. And even the tiniest changes to skin tone are noticeable. I mean, our brains are fine-tuned to notice proper skin tone. And if it's slightly green or slightly blue, then you'll notice and you'll think somebody's looking rather sickly. Or slightly red, as another example. So skin tone is something that can get messed up a little bit if you overexpose it.
Okay. So if I'm trying to bring down highlights, like in the background, can I do that while leaving the skin tones on their own?
Yes.
Okay. That might be a more extended episode.
That gets into a whole other discussion on its own. And you can even, like, Photoshop has some great tools to help correct for that as well. The auto tone feature in Photoshop, if you present it with skin tones and it recognizes skin tones, it generally will help correct for any color casts that are present. And again, you know, when I'm dealing with RAW files, the RAW file workflow really stops with Lightroom, because as soon as you bring it out of Lightroom, it's no longer a raw file. If you send it to Photoshop because you need to use some stuff in Photoshop, you know, they've got more filters and they've got more advanced editing tools, then it's now generally, and until you save it, it's going to be a TIFF file.
Right.
And that has the same bit depth as the raw file, but now if you save it and you bring it back into to whatever program you're using, Aperture or Lightroom, and you try to adjust the white balance, you no longer have the same flexibility that you did when you were dealing with just the raw file. You lose some of the benefits that the raw file gives you. So as soon as you leave the first program that touches that raw file, even like the plugins for Lightroom, if you're doing any of the like silver effects or color effects from Nick Software or any other similar stuff, they don't have access to the raw processing engine. They convert it to a TIFF file, do their magic, and then you have a second version of the file that's been a TIFF file, which you lose some of the functionality of a RAW. And that's worth noting, because I try to do as much with the RAW file before I send it out to a plugin or another piece of software, just to make sure that I'm dealing with the best possible image.
So what's a real simple tip for like processing in RAW, Don? Like, if anyone wants to basically bring up the shadows or bring back the highlights, how does one go about that?
Well, there's a slider for that.
Okay.
I mean, I mean to say that it's as simple as that. I mean, if your highlights are too bright, mm-hmm. and you don't want to affect the overall exposure, because say the midtones might be perfect, but some areas are just overexposed, like in your image when you had the sky that was too bright, you don't want to move the exposure slider down to make the sky perfect, because then everything else is going to be terrible.
Right.
It's going to be too dark. So you have sliders specifically for different areas of the image. And if you have just the brightest areas, like the overexposed areas, you move the highlight slider down or up if you want to. You know, I don't know why you'd move the highlights up, but typically you're recovering them. Or in the shadows, there's a shadow slider, and you can bring that up. And to a more generic level, there's a whites and a blacks slider, and they cover more of the mid-tone range too, so that you can affect contrast by moving those around. And that just those four sliders alone are really how you recover that. Now, if you have colors that start to skew like skin tone, there's all sorts of other things that you can go into to try and correct for it. But just the basic stuff, four simple sliders. I'm talking Lightroom. I'm sure Aperture has something very similar, and I'm sure the other software is, you know, right on par. But it's not a difficult thing. You just have to go in there and move these sliders to your liking.
It takes a little bit of messing around to figure out what it is that you like.
You're going to play around and you're going to spend hours just goofing around on an image or a set of images and not really get anywhere, but, you know, make the knowledge that you need to, you know, take it forward and make the next time when you open up an image, it's like, okay, well, yeah, I need to move this down by, you know, a couple of notches here and up on this one, and just practice and experiment and goof around, and yeah, you'll end up with weird results. I remembered in, I don't know if it's the same in Lightroom 4. I haven't played with it, but if you wanted to get like the grungy HDR kind of look on old rusted cars and that kind of stuff, if you took the black slider up and you took the fill light slider up, that's been replaced by new ones in Lightroom 4, so I'm not sure if it's the same. But if you take both of those and you bring them up, then it gives you that grungy look without having to go to an HDR program or shoot, you know, three separate images. And I thought that was kind of cool. And there's all sorts of little different things where one slider can interact with another and create completely different results.
Right. You can get down the rabbit hole pretty quick once you start messing with all the sliders.
And that's the fun. You know, it's one of those things that's, you know, simple to get the hang of, but difficult to master.
Yeah. Adam, do you use the sliders for the highlights and the shadows?
I do. I use them quite often.
What do you find more success with, bringing back the highlights or bringing up the shadows?
I guess that's tough to say. I find that I use the highlight one more often, and I think it's because if you use more than, I find anyways, if you use more than just a tiny, tiny bit of bringing the shadows out, it starts to make the image look more grainy pretty quick.
That's what I found as well. I find it a lot easier to bring the highlights down and avoid the grain. Well, basically, I'm just going to repeat what you just said. I agree.
Is that a shortcoming of Aperture? We both use Aperture. Is that the same for you, Don, using Lightroom?
Well, you know what? I find that if the shadows need to be brought up, then yes, you will get more grain when you bring them up. The noise reduction functionality in these programs is getting so good that you can, you know, mitigate that to a certain degree. I find that I've got more, I don't want to say more data because it does get grainier, but I have more ability if things are too dark to bring them up. But if they're overexposed beyond a certain point, then I can't bring them back. And I hit that point higher, or I hit that point sooner with highlights than I do with shadows.
Yeah.
So I agree with you that, yes, that bringing up the shadows is not necessarily the best way to go. But I find that I can, you know, if I work at it and I really play with the software and fine-tune things, then I can get good results.
At the end of the day, I don't think it really matters because a little noise never ruins a good photo.
Yeah, I'd much rather have a grainy photo than a blurry photo. And, yeah, you know, when I'm teaching classes, I'll tell students, you know, if you think that you're getting blurry results with your photo, crank up that ISO higher than you'd feel comfortable. Because, you know, if you can't fix it now, you might be able to fix it later, but you can never fix a blurry picture.
Right. Yep. At the end of the day, it's like arguing over Porsche and Ferrari. They're both good cars. You're driving a good car, so... Don't worry too much about it. That's my advice to people with digital.
What if you're driving a 72 Pinto?
Did they make with a custom license plate?
Did they make that in 72, Adam?
I don't know. Did they?
I have no clue.
I think they probably did.
Sure. All right. I've got to cut that out. I'm not going to. Okay, and so lastly, I think we have a general idea of... Are you of RAW? Adam, are you comfortable using RAW at this point?
I am.
How long did that take?
Until I was comfortable using it?
Yeah.
I would say probably a few months.
Okay.
I think I've been using it for a long time now, so probably close to 2 years. So it's hard for me to remember. I have trouble remembering what I had for lunch yesterday.
Okay. Generally, when you go to shoot, though, do you do a lot of correction or is it just minor tweaking?
It's pretty minor tweaking.
And that's the ultimate goal. You don't have to use the RAW. You don't have to mess around with the RAW file just because you can. Sometimes you want to have the confidence to just leave it alone. Like if you got it right, just apply your basic settings that you would normally apply and don't tweak anything. There's nothing wrong with that.
And you know what's interesting, too, is with those basic settings, in a lot of the software, and I, like I said, I can only speak for Lightroom, but I can copy those settings from one photo to the next.
Yeah.
And copy that recipe over from one photo to 100 photos or 1,000 photos. So if you're shooting a wedding in a church and the lighting is awful and you spend all the time on one image to get the lighting, you know, the colors to look right, you can copy that setting, you know, just the block of all those sliders, and paste it to everything else. You don't have to do it multiple times. And that is a huge time saver when it comes to, you know, if you were doing it in Photoshop, there are ways that you can, you know, that you can get away with certain presets in Adobe Camera Raw. But Lightroom just makes it so easy.
And I remember, I think I forgot to tell Adam that little feature early on.
Oh, yeah, you let me sort of go for a good 6 months of doing it one by one.
It never occurred to me because it's such a natural part of my workflow, because that's exactly what happens, and mostly for white balance, where it's a situation where I have the white balance very close but not bang on, and then I will then correct all the images or make them all black and white or whatever it is. And it's such a normal, everyday part of my workflow that I just assumed that everybody did it.
Yeah, it was a revelation to me, and I'm happy. I'm not going to go back and think about all the hours I wasted. I'm just going to think about all the hours I've saved in the last 6 or 8 months, however I've known that trick. It was during your last visit to Vancouver that you showed me that, and then the big light bulb went off. And I thought, hey, wow, that's a good feature. I wish I knew about that.
Now you do.
I've got another tool in my bag of tricks that, you know, you've got to use this in the field, but it helps the editing time get brought down considerably. Have either of you ever heard or used the Color Checker Passport from X-Rite?
I have heard of it, have not used it.
It's a brilliant little thing. It's the size of a passport, and it just has an array of colors inside it that you take a picture of in whatever lighting conditions you're making your images. Then in Lightroom, all you have to do is export that to the plugin generated, that belongs to this particular tool, and it'll create a custom camera profile, and it will automatically correct all of your colors for you, and then you just select that as a camera profile option. And it's a huge time saver. It's not going to bring back color spectrum that's not being outputted by the light. Say, if you're under horrible fluorescent lighting and the colors are terrible, it's not going to give you colors that don't exist in the image. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a whole other topic altogether.
This is a calibration device.
It's a calibration device so that you're not fiddling with those sliders to the nth degree to get that, you know, that shade of red perfect on that jersey or, you know, whatever it happens to be. All you're doing is taking this one image that took 5 seconds to take a picture of and creating a profile on that so that you're not wasting time down the road in post-processing. And I'm a huge fan of making post-processing simple and easy and fast. I will spend a lot of time on some images that need to go into Photoshop and whatnot, but if I'm in Lightroom, it is just bang, bang, bang. Everything is quick and easy.
Great.
Now, is that any better than using a gray card?
Well, gray card will help you correct for white balance. And that's perfect, and that's half the battle right there. But if you're, if every camera sensor is going to be slightly different, even within the same model of camera. My 5D Mark II I bought at launch, it's going to have a slightly different sensor, or it's going to function slightly differently than one that you buy today.
Okay, I see.
And so the colors will be slightly off. It's the same as if you're calibrating a monitor. They all come the exact same way from the factory, or so they should, but they don't. So you have a calibrator for the monitor and for your printer and for everything else to make sure that the accuracy is living up to what they say.
Okay.
So there's that for a camera, too.
And lastly, before we wrap this up, when you take your pictures down to London Drugs or wherever it is that you get them printed, do you take that raw file?
They would laugh at you, or they would say, "This isn't a photograph."
I think it'd be more confusion than anything. I don't think the kiosk would read your image.
That's right. Very few kiosks will read TIFF files. Most of them will just read JPEGs. And I worked at Black's Photography here in Barrie for a number of years, And we'd have some people come in and they'd try to bring in RAW files, or they'd just bring in their memory card. They didn't even necessarily know they were shooting in RAW. And I have to tell them politely that, yeah, you know what? We can't process this for you because there's a step missing. This is not an image. This is just like an unprocessed negative. And we're just not set up to do that there. And most people, if you bring a RAW file to any printer, unless it's a private boutique printer, won't know how to handle it.
Right. So that's I output as JPEG as well. Adam?
Same.
JPEG.
JPEG.
That's the last final step. So that's it. That's the part two of RAW right there. So if there's any questions, we're going to give Don's home phone number at the end of this. No, we're not. We're going to give your home phone number, Don.
All right. It's 555.
Wow. The silence is killing me there. Challenge for next week, Adam. What do you think?
I got one.
Do it.
I saw your potential photo challenge, and I said, no, that's not good enough.
Oh, I phoned that one in.
Yeah, no, that was not good enough. Time of year, buddy. I can't believe you haven't suggested it yet. Spring. How about a spring photo?
Spring has sprung.
Yeah.
All right. Spring it is. I might shoot a slinky, though. I'm going to warn you.
There you go. Well, it's all open to interpretation.
Yeah, I'm going to shoot my wife's eye. Yeah. There you go.
You just never know. That could still be spring.
Spring. I'm in. So.
All right.
Okay. Well, until next week, where can people find your stuff, Don?
Best place is doncom.ca. That's doncom.ca. Look me up on Google Plus too. I'm quite active there. And, of course, Outdoor Photography Canada. If you haven't subscribed to the magazine, if you haven't read it, I highly recommend it. And my opinion is biased, but I don't think yours is, Alan, and you vouch for it too. So,
yeah, Adam also liked it.
Yeah, I haven't seen the most recent issue, but the last issue that you sent me, I really enjoyed.
Very helpful, unpretentious, and not tremendously ad heavy.
Yeah, and some really nice photos.
Yeah. Fantastic. So, Adam, where can people find your stuff?
SchwartzChronicles.com. So there was a very recent post describing all that is good about hockey still, post Canucks loss from the playoffs. So with a couple of the floor hockey pictures of my daughter as potentially the next Canucks goaltender.
Good to hear.
Yeah. And how about your stuff, Al?
As always, at alanattridge.com or the two of us at twohosers.com, where you can find everything you want to know about the Google Plus, the Flickr, the Twitter, the what iTunes, whatever you want. Twohosers.com. So that's it. Until next week, guys, get out there and make better photos.